From Quality Radio Productions, it's the Upstate Radio Theater. I'm Jake Longwell. Opening the program this time with an episode of Rogue's Gallery. This crime drama enjoyed five runs during radio's golden era between 1945 and 1951. It was an offshoot of the Fitch Bandwagon variety show, which starred song and dance man Dick Powell. Powell transitioned to private investigator in Rogue's Gallery, and of course he would go on to star in another outstanding PI series, Richard Diamond, Private Detective, in the late 40s and early 50s. This broadcast is from near the end of the second run of the series on Mutual. The series would move to NBC 2 weeks later. From June 13th, 1946, here is The Corpse I Didn't Kill.
The F.W. Fitch Company presents Dick Powell as private investigator Richard Rogue in Rogue's Gallery.
Laugh a while, let a song be your style, use Fitch shampoo. Don't despair, use your head, save your hair, use Fitch shampoo.
The F.W. Fitch Company, makers of Fitch's saponified coconut oil shampoo and Fitch's shaving creams, presents Dick Powell as private investigator Richard Rogue in Rogue's Gallery.
Rogue speaking. You know, I'm a man who loves sunshine, in or out of orange juice. And the only place that has more sunshine per square inch than the Sahara Desert is the San Fernando Valley. San Fernando seems to be the place where everybody, including some of the healthiest gophers in the world, makes his home but me. I've withstood the blandishments of hundreds of brick-red real estate men who have offered me membership in that clan of plaid-shirted, tight blue-jeaned, high-heel-booted fraternity known as the San Fernando Valley Ranchers. Ranchers. Yes, sir. The San Fernando Valley has ranches that are thicker than any place in the world. There are at least two on every acre. Well, anyway, I was driving around out there this Sunday evening. It was swimming weather. And I happened to remember that my friend Joe Dale had a half-acre spread in the neighborhood with a quarter-acre swimming pool. So I stopped at the Antlers on the gate, rang the ship's bell hanging there, but nobody answered. I thought maybe Joe was in the pool in the rear, so I opened the door and walked in. Then I felt like walking out again, because I saw Joe Dale lying there, making a red stain on the white living room rug, very defunct. I walked over to him and gazed down at him. Then I heard the footsteps behind me and did a half turn in time to see oblivion whistling down on my head. Oh. Everything went red, white, and blue. And I was whirling like a top. Oh, it made me dizzy whirling like that. I couldn't stand the shrieking of the wind as it whistled past my ears. I concentrated on stopping so hard that I could hear my teeth gritting. But no go. Then I thought of Ugor. And suddenly I heard his pleasant voice.
Come on, Sheepy. Welcome home to Cloudy.
Oh, my head.
Funny looking, ain't he?
Wait till he sees you.
Ugor. Who is this ancient feather merchant with you?
Well, Rogie, I want you. This is her father.
You mean the little dame's father?
Is he talking about my daughter?
Yes, sir.
What's he doing with that gun? He couldn't pull the trigger with a tractor.
Will you see, Chiefy?
You're the young whippersnapper who's advising you go here. Not to marry my daughter, huh? Well, let me tell you something.
Oh, shut up. I don't feel good.
Rogie, you're making things tough for me. Her father has a gun.
I'm not going to stand for much more fooling around, you guys.
Oh, make him stop talking. His voice sounds like a grindstone on a grindstone.
Now, looky here, young fella. I'm a gentleman of the old school. And if my daughter is half-witted enough to want to marry this good-for-nothing you got.
Oh, no, no. I'm not going to let my alter ego get married. Ugor can't get married.
Oh, that's a mighty selfish way of looking at things, Rokey.
Oh, look. Look, my head. I don't feel good. I came up here for a rest.
Now, we're going to have a serious talk, Mr. Earl. My daughter's happiness is a mighty important thing to me.
Oh, shut up. Shut up. Shut up. I can't stand that silly voice of yours.
But he's right, Rokey. You can't stand in the way of our happiness. It's not fair. It's only normal to want to get married.
Now, look at it from our point of view, Mr. Elk. Here's a couple of...
I can't stand it. I'm getting out of here.
Grab him.
Come back here. Come back here.
When I came to, I was looking right in Joe Dale's face, which was inches from mine. The inside of my head was still whirling and clanking like a washing machine, but it didn't take me long to get back up to date. I remembered I had dropped in at Joe Dale's house for a quick swim and found Joe stretched out on the living room floor, shot. Then I remembered that swishing sound, which always means another bump on my head. And now my feet felt like they were in diver's shoes as I got up and looked the situation over. The murder gun was lying there by the side of Joe's body, and there was a billfold on the floor by the door. Being the kind of a guy I am, I picked up the billfold first. It was Joe Dale's, and I put it in my pocket. Then I took my handkerchief and carefully picked up the gun. I was bending over Joe, gun in hand, when I heard a voice behind me.
Joe! Joe!
A beautiful dame had walked in on me and caught me bending over the corpse, gun in hand. She fainted. I ran over to her. Hey, come out of it, lady. Lady, hey, come on. Oh, come on. Oh, Lord, everything happens to me. Come on, come out of it. Open your eyes. But she didn't. And while I was working on her, a man showed up in the open door. He took one look at the tableau and dived for the murder gun, which I'd dropped. He pointed the gun at my third vest button and said,
"Just stay right where you are. I know how to shoot this thing, and I'm holding you for the police. Your partner got away, but I'll see..."
"Look, mister. Look, I am the police. I
know who you are. You're Richard Rowe, the private investigator. You've been mixed up in plenty of shady deals before. What did you do to my wife?"
"Is this your wife?"
"Yes. What's the matter with her?"
"Well, she came in, saw Joe Dale's body, and fainted."
"Barry. Is that you?"
"Yes, dear. Now, don't worry. I'm here, and I'll take care of you."
This man, he was standing over Joe's body with a gun in his hand when I came in. He's a killer, Barry. Be careful."
"Don't worry, dear. I have him covered. Stay right there, Rogue. I'm a nervous man, and I advise you not to move while I'm phoning the police."
We'll return to our story in just a moment. First, time was when heavy perfumed oils were considered the thing for pleasant-smelling hair. Now, of course, we know that the clean, delicate fragrance imparted to the hair by Fitch's saponified coconut oil shampoo is much more the modern idea of good grooming. This clear, golden liquid shampoo makes an abundance of creamy lather that does an efficient job of cleansing the hair. It removes dust, perspiration, oily film, and all unpleasant scalp odors. Leaves the hair with a gloriously fresh, clean feeling. And Fitch's saponified shampoo is made from mild coconut and pure vegetable oils. Thus, you can use it as often as you like, because Fitch's saponified coconut oil shampoo does not rob your hair of its natural oils. Always leaves it soft, lustrous, and manageable. Next time you're at your barber or beauty shop, ask for a professional application of Fitch's saponified coconut oil shampoo. Or buy an economical bottle at your drug or toilet goods counter. Look for the bottle with the bright yellow label. Now back to Dick Powell as Private Investigator Richard Rogue in Rogue's Gallery.
I couldn't very well blame Perry Stevens or his wife for thinking I just put the kiss of death on Joe Dale.
Mrs. Stevens came in and saw me bending over the body with a murder gun in my hand, promptly fainted. And so when Perry arrived, the floor was cluttered with bodies, and I was the only stranger. He picked up the killer's gun and held me at the point of it until the cops arrived. Lieutenant Urban of Homicide was in charge, as usual. He seemed a little bit discouraged with me.
Well, Rogie, what's your story?
Urban, it's a simple one. I just dropped in here to take a swim and found Joe Dale dead.
Why didn't you report the murder to Homicide?
I didn't have a chance. The killer was hiding here in the room. He slapped me silly and escaped while I was out. How do you think I got this cut on my head, shaving?
I never know about you.
There were two of them, Lieutenant. I saw one of them run out from behind this house. A big man, red-haired, rough. This man here, this Richard Rogue, had an accomplice.
When I came in, Mr. Rogue was bending over the body with a gun. That gun in his hand. I almost caught him in the act.
How about it, Rogie?
Well, I was bending over the body, all right. I'd just come to. I was checking up.
Why didn't you call Homicide when you came to?
I was going to, Urban, but this dame here walked in on me, screamed, fainted.
I demanded to arrest this man.
Oh, wait a minute. What were you doing here?
I came over to...
Joe was an old friend. We just came over to take him to dinner. Don't try to implicate a couple of law-abiding people in your crime.
You and your wife came together?
Of course.
Then how come she came in ahead of you?
I hesitated when I saw that man run out from behind the house. Lieutenant, do I have to stand here and let this murderer cross-question me?
Mrs. Stevens, you and your husband came here together?
Yes. We had a dinner date with Joe.
Did you see this man run away from the house?
No, I came right straight inside.
Okay. Look, Rogie, you'd better come down to headquarters with me right now. We've got some talking to do.
Urban, I'll be down in an hour. I want to go to the emergency hospital and have my head put back on. I got to go home and get a suit without these red polka dots. Then I'll be down.
I demand that you put Rogue under arrest, Lieutenant.
Now, take it easy, Mr. Stevens. I've had a little more experience with this sort of thing than you have. See you in an hour, Rogie. Be there.
That gash on my head had cost me a lot of blood, and I was a little woozy as I left the ex-residence of the late Joe Dale. I drove turtle speed to the emergency hospital, where the doc made a few insulting remarks about me getting scars on the scars on my poor head. And then I went home. I walked in the door, and an arm went around my throat. A crooked elbow squeezed my Adam's apple until I choked. I felt a hand sneak into my inside breast pocket and lift that wallet I'd picked up on the floor beside Joe Dale's body. The elbow squeezed a little tighter, 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 and I had a horrifying sensation of bursting lungs. And then the elbow released me, and I fell to the floor, to the accompaniment of departing footsteps. I was still lying there when Urban walked in through the open door.
I got worried about you when you didn't show up, Rogie. What happened?
I don't know. I guess I just got faint, flopped over here. I lost a lot of blood, you know.
Better take care of yourself, Rogie. I don't want to lose you. Feel like talking?
Oh, sure, but I don't know anything to talk about.
Maybe you'd like to talk about a murder.
Well, tell me, did you get a line on that red-headed guy that was seen leaving Joe's house?
I've got a description out on him. Nothing's happened yet.
How about Mr. and Mrs. Stevens? Check up on them?
Yeah. Stevens is the personnel director for an airplane company. Pays his bills promptly, has money in the bank, lives within his income. And he's been a friend of Joe Dale's since college days. They're clean. That leaves you and a big red-headed guy in the finals. One of you killed Joe Dale. I don't think you did it, but I could get an indictment against you in 20 minutes for the evidence I have.
No, but I didn't kill him. I didn't like him well enough. Well, I guess it's up to me to find the big red-headed guy, huh? You checked the gun?
No soap. The number was filed off, and the only fingerprints on it were Stevens. And they got on it when he was holding you.
Yeah, I was there when it happened, remember? Oh, brother. Brother, do I feel weary. Well, there's one thing I'll swear to. Mrs. Stevens was not expecting to find Dale murdered. She really went out like a butler on Thursday night.
You know, Rogie, I'm a cop. And the fact that you and I understand each other doesn't make any difference to the commissioner.
Yeah, I know.
Joe Dale was a pretty prominent character. Lots of connections. Now, the commissioner expects a quick pinch. And with our friends, the Stevens, down there at City Hall, swearing that they saw you standing over the body with a practically smoking gun in your hand, well, it looks like it's going to be you I put the arm on.
Oh, but you know I didn't kill him, Urban.
Why would I want to kill a guy like that?
Yes,
for?
I know you didn't kill him, but the newspapers are on the old man. He's on the chief, and the chief's on me. I'm going to have to pinch you, Rogie.
You're a great pal, Irvin. But look, if you pinch me, they'll never get a conviction. You know that you can't get a conviction without a motive.
I know that, but you've made a lot of enemies around headquarters, Rogie. They see a chance to give you a bad time, and they don't want to miss it. You can see the spot I'm in.
Yeah. Now, look, Irvin. Give me 24 hours to get the guy that pulled the boom on Joe Dale. Just 24 hours, and I'll have him for you.
Oh, that's whistling in the dark, Rogie.
Yeah, with a 10 whistle. But just give me a chance at it anyway. Maybe I'll be lucky.
Okay. It'll probably put me back on a beat, but I'll play along with you. You've got 24 hours, Rogue. Then, don't make me come after you. Come in and give yourself up.
The deal?
Yeah,
the deal. You're a good cop, Irvin. I know you're sticking your neck out like a turtle at feeding time, and believe me, I won't let you down.
Okay, Rogue, I'll get out. Better get some sleep.
You look awful. I can't afford the luxury of sleeping. I got work to do.
Okay, Rogue, call me if you need me. I'll be around. Lots of luck. You'll need it.
Hello?
Hello. It's Lieutenant Irvin there.
Just a minute. Hey, Irvin.
Yeah? For me?
Yeah. He'll be right here. Hang on. Mighty excited little man on the other end of this.
Yeah? Hello. Irvin speaking.
Lieutenant Irvin, this is Perry Stevens.
Yeah? And what do you want?
That man, that red-headed man that I saw running away from Joe's house this afternoon.
Yes.
He came here tonight to my house.
What did you do?
He came here to kill me, but I shot him. He's dead. Please come out at once.
I'll be right there. Now, don't move a thing till I get there. Come on, Rogie.
Well, this puts that eight ball I was behind over the corner pocket, doesn't it, Irvin?
Yeah, looks like Stevens wrapped his case up for us.
And that makes me very happy. Oh, I wasn't looking forward to sweating it out in a jail of yours. No, I didn't have anything against that red-headed guy, but I'm never going to miss him.
Yeah, it takes me off the spot, too, you know.
Yeah, well, you don't have to be a hero in my corner. Oh, well, all's well that ends well, to coin a phrase.
It's right down this next block here.
Huh? Stevens must have a lot of cabbage, big houses in this neighborhood.
Yeah, I checked that. The wife's got money. Oh, there it is, that two-story white shop. There's the precinct prowl car in front. The boys are on the job.
Well, let's get with it.
Good evening, Lieutenant.
Hello, Bauer. Medical examiner here yet?
No, not yet. Precinct boys just got here.
Thanks. Come on, Rogie.
Well, this is quite a layout. Wife's got dough, huh?
Yeah, and Uncle left her plenty about a year ago.
Makes it nice for Perry.
Oh, what a mind.
Yeah, you know, someday Betty Callahan and I are going to have a chicken ranch out here in this valley.
Look, we're investigating a murder. That's serious business.
All right, Charlie, pick it up.
Hello, boys. Where is he?
Right in there, Lieutenant.
Thanks.
Well, Lieutenant, it's about time you were getting here.
We came as fast as we could, Stevens. Now, suppose you tell me what happened.
I'll be glad to. My wife and I got home tonight.
Where is your wife?
Is he any right to question me in that tone of voice, Lieutenant?
Where is your wife?
Why, the shock was too much for her. She's upstairs.
Don't blame her. She's had enough for today. Come on, what happened? You got him with that shotgun, eh?
Yes. I was frightened, terribly frightened, and as soon as I came home, I got my shotgun. I hunt a little, you know, and I put it here beside my chair. It was just a hunch.
Yeah?
The doorbell rang. My wife answered the door. We thought it was a neighbor. This red-headed man walked in. I recognized him at once. He was the man I'd seen run away from Joe's house. He had a gun. He was going to kill me. I suppose because I was the only eyewitness to the crime.
Well, that makes sense.
It certainly does. It's the truth. He turned to talk to my wife. I saw my chance. I shot him. There he is. Your murderer. I've never seen anybody killed before.
Well, he's sure dead.
Yeah. Ever seen him before?
No, not that I know of. Hey, what are you doing, Rogie?
Oh, I'm just trying to get some identification on the guy, that's all. Little shakedown. I thought... Uh-oh.
What's the matter?
Oh, an alligator billfold. I didn't expect to see one on this guy. And hey, Urban, this is Joe Dale's billfold. And it's full of dough. Yeah, let's see. Yeah, several hundred bucks in it.
Yeah, that's the final piece of evidence.
I'll take care of it.
Well, there's the medical examiner, and the newspapers are about due to arrive. You've done a good night's work, Mr. Stevens. I want to thank you.
I'm not a man of violence. I'll never be able to forget this night.
There was something about that wallet that was as strange as a bride in black. Other identification on the body pegged the redhead as one Tom Church, recently of the Navy, now a resident of the Crane Hotel. I watched for my chance to give Urban and his minions the slip and faded away. I went to police headquarters and charged into the identification bureau on a dead run. I handed the sergeant in charge the wallet and asked him to dust it for fingerprints. Then I waited. When the sergeant came back, his jaw was stuck out like the business end of a snowplow, and there were icicles in his voice.
What's the deal, Rogie?
What's the matter with you? All I ask you to do is to give me the identification on the fingerprints you found on the billfold.
Yeah. Do you know whose prints I found, you wise private creep, do you? Yours. Only yours.
We'll return to our story in a moment. First, a word to the ladies. Did you ever make the remark that your hair never was manageable after a shampoo until it was time to wash it again? That's been the experience of many a woman. Well, you can have your hair immaculately clean, lustrous, and manageable, too. Try using Fitch's Saponified Coconut Oil Shampoo for your hair care. This shampoo is made from pure natural oils and leaves your hair soft and manageable even immediately after shampooing. Its creamy, fragrant lather never dries the hair, but cleanses gently, removing dirt, perspiration, and every trace of unpleasant scalp odors. Fitch's Saponified Shampoo brings out the gleaming, natural color highlights in your hair, too, and leaves it clean and fragrant. A special patented rinsing agent contained right in the shampoo leaves your hair sparkling clean and free from any dull, soapy film. Try Fitch's Saponified Coconut Oil Shampoo the next time you want an extra special beauty treat for your hair. Then use it regularly to keep your hair soft, fragrant, and lovely. Now back to Dick Powell as Private Investigator Richard Rogue in Rogue's Gallery.
The news that the only fingerprints on that billfold were mine turned on the floodlights. And one of my hunches picked up a hammer and started pounding against my skull. I left the billfold there for Urban and took off for the Crane Hotel to check up on the red-headed guy named Tom Church. The hotel was a fourth-class flea bag on Main Street. The clerk took a look at my buzzer and answered my questions. That's right, Shorty. I'm the law. And I want some answers. Now tell me, how long has Tom Church been registered here?
Tom Church, 3 days. He came in 3 days ago.
All right. Now let me see his phone calls.
Oh, we don't give out phone
calls. Now don't lip me. Give them to me before I jump over that counter and stand on you while I pick them up.
Oh, okay. You look like just the kind of guy that could do it. I'll get them for you.
I checked the phone calls and found one of them had a message that was going to ring somebody's number for the surprise party. I thanked the clerk and drove to the valley. The pre-dawn gray made way for the sunshine just as I walked up the front walk at Dale's house. An elderly man walked around the next ranch, pushing a lawnmower.
Hey, are you a policeman?
That's right, yes.
A horrible thing, that murder yesterday. Did they get the killer yet?
Well, I think so. Yeah. Were you home yesterday afternoon at the time of the killing?
Yeah, I wasn't paying much attention, you know. I heard the shot, but I thought it was a backfire,
Look, old-timer, I want you to tell me everything you saw and heard after that shot, will you?
Well, you see, I was sitting in my living room reading the evening paper, you know, and I saw you drive up. You sure you're a policeman, mister?
Why, yes, of course.
Yes, well, I'd like to see your credentials. You know, you were the first man I saw enter there.
All right, here's the dope on me. Here, the sheriff's office loves me. There it is. Satisfied?
Yes. I've heard of you, Mr. Rogue. Well, after you drove up, the lady arrived and...
What do you want, Mr. Rogue?
Mrs. Stevens, I'm coming in. I want to talk with you.
No, come back later.
I'm sorry. Go on in and sit down.
What do you want?
Some answers. Sit down. Now, where's your husband?
Asleep. Nothing ever wakens him.
All right, let's get right to it, huh? What were you to Joe Dale?
I don't know what you mean.
Mrs. Stevens, you've been seeing Joe a lot, haven't you? Now, don't bother lying. I've got witnesses. You and Joe Dale were better friends than your husband knew, weren't you?
Oh, no. I used to meet Joe once in a while to talk over investments he was making for me.
Uh-huh. At his house? In the afternoons, usually, huh?
Yes.
Mrs. Stevens, your husband killed Joe Dale. You lied when you said that the two of you had a dinner date with Joe last night. I just talked to your husband's secretary. He was supposed to be in San Francisco yesterday.
No.
Yes. But instead, he went out in the valley and killed Dale. I practically surprised him in the act. He got panicky, knocked me out, and ran.
No, he didn't. He didn't.
I can prove what I'm saying, Mrs. Stevens. You came up in your car alone. Your husband came up in a cab a few minutes later. He had to get back in to get that wallet and the gun to make the murder look like a robbery. And he picked the gun up so there'd be a reason for his fingerprints on it. Then he went to my apartment and collected the wallet after choking me half to death. Are you with him then?
You're just making this up. You can't prove it.
Mart! Don't say any more. It's a little late for that, Stevens. You've bungled the job all the way through. And you won't be needing that gun.
Harry, don't. Don't shoot.
Give me that gun, Stevens. You'd be crazy to get in a shooting contest with me. You'll stay right where you are, Rogue. I'm not afraid to shoot.
Marge, they can't make you appear against me. That's the law. If you stay with me...
I'm coming after that gun, Stevens.
You stay where you are, Rogue. Marge. Marge, stop looking at me like that. Nobody knows anything about what I did, but Rogue and...
No. No, Perry. You killed them. And I'm glad to get rid of you.
You... Marge, you can't. Don't sell me out.
I've been frightened to death ever since I've married to you. Take that gun away from him, Rogue. Take it away from him.
Give me the gun, Stevens.
Get away from me, Rogue. Marge, you're going back on me. You can't do that, Marge. We're in this thing together.
Let me have that gun, Stevens.
I should have shot you instead of him. Give me that gun or I'll break your arm off. Give it to me.
Okay, Stevens. This is the end of Easy Street for you. Well, that finished that case. Stevens went to the gas chamber on Marge's testimony, and Marge is still in prison on an accessory rap. The red-headed kid, Tom Church, was an innocent victim. He'd been interviewed by Stevens for a job the day before. Stevens knew he had no relatives, no connections, so he decided to frame him for the murder of Joe Dale. He described Church to the police, then called him at his hotel and asked him to come to Stevens' home for an interview about a job. If Church had been in when the call came, I might have muffed the case. But he was out, and Stevens left his number for a callback. That was luck, I guess, but I don't know. I think I would have solved the case anyway. Yeah, of course, I didn't make a dime out of it. Oh, well, money can't buy happiness. But it can buy a lot of things that make unhappiness pleasant, can't it? Oh, you know what I mean. This is Dick Powell again, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you enjoyed our story tonight. Ray Buffum wrote it, Leith Stevens composed and conducted the music, and Dee Engelbach produced and directed. Next week, we have a story for you about a missing witness, a worried rogue, and an ambush that failed. Be with us then, will you? Thanks for listening, and now here's Jim Doyle.
Be sure to tune in again next week, same time, same station, when you will again hear Dick Powell as Private Investigator Richard Rogue in Rogue's Gallery.
Laugh a while, let a song be a style, use Fitch Shampoo. Don't despair, use your head, save your hair, use Fitch Shampoo.
After and between Fitch shampoos, you can keep your hair shining and manageable by using a few drops of Fitch's Ideal Hair Tonic every day. Fitch's Ideal Hair Tonic is not sticky or greasy, yet it gives your hair that well-groomed look. Thank you.
From June 13th, 1946, on the Mutual Broadcasting System, Dick Powell in Rogue's Gallery, The Corpse I Didn't Kill, program number 51 in that series. Powell was replaced in 1947 by Barry Sullivan for the summer 1947 run of the series on NBC, and for the final run of Rogue's Gallery on ABC from 1949 to 1951, Paul Stewart portrayed Richard Rogue. You are listening to the Upstate Radio Theater. I'm Jake Longwell. If you want to get in touch with the program, our email address is qualityradioproductions@gmail.com. And please visit our blog and website at qualityradioproductions.blogspot.com. You'll find much more info about the radio theater there. And if you're looking for the playlist or audio for this episode of the show, it's program 1535. We'll wrap up the hour with some classic British comedy as we turn to one of my favorite BBC sketch comedy programs, I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again. The series starred, among others, John Cleese, Tim Brooke-Taylor, Bill Oughty, David Hatch, and Joe Kendall. It enjoyed a 9-year run on the Beeb from 1964 through 1973. This broadcast is program number 12 in the second season of I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again, from May 30th, 1966, and I will warn you that some of the humor here might be a bit adult in nature, so listener discretion is advised. Here is Tim Brown's School Days.
Never mind, I'm a busy man. Look, I'm an agent. Who are you?
Beethoven, sir.
You'll have to change it. What have you got then? Is it commercial? If not, why not?
I've got a tune, sir. It's a song, and I've not got any words.
Is it R&B, folk, minuet, gavotte? Who cares? So let's hear it. Can you whistle?
Well, I've brought along a few friends to play it for
you. Good. Well, give us your song then. Come on, swing it. Let's have it.
Eins, zwei, drei.
Well, that's a load of old rubbish, isn't it? And mind you, you never can tell. Tchaikovsky does it. Why not you? Of course, the arrangement's wrong. What's in there?
20 violins, 10 violas, 8 cellos, 4 basses and a brass section.
Try it on guitar. That's more like it. That's more like it. Now jazz it up a bit. Come on, jazz it up. Give it a bit of rhythm. That's good. It's good. It's good. It's coming. It's coming. Hey, I'll tell you what's wrong.
What?
The tune. Try it going up. Try it going up.
Ta ta ta
ta ta ta ta ta ta ta ta ta. Yes, it's coming. It's coming. Wait a minute. I've got it. Ta 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 ta
ta ta ta ta ta
ta ta ta ta ta ta ta ta ta ta ta ta.
Once again, the Ludwig van Prune tune spotlights the talents of Tim Brooke-Taylor, John Cleese, Graham Garden, David Hatch, Joe Kendall, and Bill Oddie. And here, towering under the microphone, is your own, your very own, John Otto Cleese.
I'm sorry. I'll read that again. Again. Oh, I'd love to be alone in the country.
John?
Yes?
I'm with you.
I'd love to be alone in the country.
But John, you brought me with you.
I didn't. You hid in the back.
But you must have noticed.
Not at all. It's a very large tandem.
But John, when we fell off going down the stairs... You must have seen me.
I thought you were a hitchhiker.
But I'm your wife. You must have recognized me.
I didn't, Mary.
Why not?
Oh, because you were disguised as a cactus.
Oh, John. John. Talk to me. Say something to me. Say you hate me. Say I'm ugly.
Which?
Say I'm ugly.
You're ugly.
You're only saying that. You don't really mean it. You don't care. You never think about me. Up and down all night, warming the milk, mashing the rust, all the crying and the bed wetting.
Yes, I know.
I wouldn't mind if we had a baby.
Well, I'm sorry, but I prefer bisons.
John, why don't you admit it? You don't love me anymore.
All right, I admit it.
John... Once we had something that was pure and wonderful and good. What's happened to it?
You've spent it all.
That's all that matters to you, isn't it? Money. I despise you. Do you hear me? I hate you. I don't know how I've been able to stand it. I suppose it's because I love you. I don't know. I do love you, John. I love you more than I can say. I need you, John. Please, John, don't look at photographs of nude women while I'm talking to you.
Oh, all right, but... I know you know.
You know?
Yes.
Oh, God. John.
Yes?
What do you know?
Well, I could be wrong.
You mean about me and Nigel?
Oh, I was wrong. I thought it was Rupert.
You're right. It is Rupert. I can never remember names.
Anyway, I do know about last Friday.
Last Friday?
Yes. He was in my bed, wasn't he?
How did you know?
He kept pushing me out.
You mean you were there too?
You didn't even notice? Oh, God.
John. John. Try to love me.
No, Mary, it's no good. You somehow manage to hurt everyone you love.
Well, I'll take the cactus skin off.
No, Mary, look. There's something I've been meaning to tell you.
What?
Cardinal Richelieu died in 1642.
All right, so Mother was wrong. But can't we forget the past? I mean, that's all history now. Don't let's dig it up again.
You never liked me being an archaeologist, did you?
I never said that.
You'd have been happier if I'd sharpened knives or sold ferrets.
Keep George out of this.
No, I'm not going to keep George out of this. If you had to have a lover, why did it have to be a ferret seller? Lasted ferrets all over the house for months. Why couldn't it have been the budgerigar man? At least budgerigars can sing beautifully. I can still remember waking up in the morning and hearing all those ferrets singing. It used to drive me mad. Always the same tune.
That's all over now. Can't we forget it? I mean, couldn't we start all over again? I mean, go back and begin from the beginning.
I suppose we could try.
Please, John.
All right. Oh, how I love to be alone in the country. How I love to be alone in the country.
But, John, you...
It's time now for another in the series, Stories from Shakespeare, told by David Pushoff.
Hello, children. Now, gather round and I'll tell you all a tale. Once upon a time, and not so very long ago... There lived in a very cold place called Denmark a young fellow by the name of Hamlet. He lived with his mother, Elsie, and his wicked stepfather, Norman, in a great big palace called Elsie Nor. Now Hamlet was a good boy and loved his mother. But he was very jealous of his wicked stepfather, the King of Denmark, no less. And so, one day, Hamlet decided to do away with his wicked stepfather. And that night, he told his mother about it. She was astounded. Oi, oi, she cried. Is this my little boy? But Hamlet had made up his mind already. And so he cunningly got hold of some deadly, undetectable poison from the delicatessen on the corner and put it in a glass of wine. But who should drink the wine but his own mama? What confusion! People running to and fro, as like as not, And Hamlet's girlfriend, Ophelia, jumping in the river. And did she have problems? And so Hamlet picked up a sword with the poisoned point, which was lying around, and stabbed his wicked stepfather. But it just wasn't his lucky day. Hamlet accidentally scratched himself with the poisoned sword, and that was that. Well, children, next week I'll tell you the story of Macbeth, another murder story. And nobody murders stories like I do.
We are now interrupting the program with news of an unhappy event. We are deeply grieved to announce that tomorrow at 12 o'clock midday, the Earth is due to be destroyed by falling into the sun. First, the Prime Minister's reaction. The nation as a whole is taking the news calmly. Since the Earth is due to be destroyed at midday, tomorrow will be a day of mourning. For first reactions from Fleet Street, over to what the papers say.
Well, several of today's papers lead with the story of the world's destruction. Typical headlines are the Mirrors.
Wow, which bikini weather.
And the Express.
Save our royal family.
Owing to the news of the world's impending destruction, the BBC announces a change in its programmes for tonight. At 9 o'clock, the Prime Minister will address the nation. If he can be found in time. And now, in place of our advertised program 24 hours, we have a special program, 12 hours.
And first of all, we've been asked to ask you not to panic.
Panic!
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 Panicking.
And now, sport. Over to the president of the FA.
The two semi-finals of the FA Cup have been brought forward and will be played at 8 o'clock this evening. The final will be played at 10:30 tomorrow morning. There'll be no extra time.
Well, while we were hearing that report, a listener has rung in to say that he's just heard the last cuckoo. And now, Darcy Fitch.
When he heard the news today, walking down Tottenham Court Road with his banner, Mr. Fred Peer, chairman of the End of the World Is at Hand Society, died of shock.
And that is the end of the news. I'm sorry, I'll read that again. That is the news of the end. There are plenty of songs about the joys of eating. But how about a song to help people slim? Here from Bill Oddie and the Boys is a cautionary tale.
Uncle Henry bought himself some teeth the other day, and he was so excited he got carried right away. He was chewing day and night, chomping everything in sight. He even ate the furniture and half a dog as well. I tell you, Uncle Henry soon put on an awful lot of weight. He was up to 16 stone, and as a rule, he's only 8. When we rolled him on the scale, its little face went pale, and its tiny voice inside was heard to murmur. Take it all,
take it all,
take it all,
take it all.
No, you can't be seen in public, not like that. Now I know it may seem ruthless, but you were better toothless. Now everybody says you're far too fat. Well, Lulu was a stripper and she had just what it takes. In generous proportions, built on lemon juice and steaks. And when she needed stuffing, instead of eating muffin, she'd have one of those rolls. But when you bite into the crust, there's nothing. But our Lulu dropped our diet sheet and went astray. She started eating bread and buns and grew a bit each day. Till one night in her dance, she showed such a vast expanse that as she went to drop the lot, she heard a fella say, take it off!
Take it off!
Take it off!
Take it off!
Oh, you can't go out in public, not like that.
And I'm in trouble.
Now, blimey, look at you. You've got enough for two. And everybody says you're far too fat. All together, take it off!
Take it off!
Take it off!
Take it off.
Take it off. Oh, you can't go out in public, not like that.
And I'm in
trouble. You can keep your mashed potato. Just give me my vibrator. Cause everybody says you're far too fat.
Set among the desolate Yorkshire moors stands an ominous cluster of grey stone buildings whose walls have withstood the ravages of the centuries. From this grim fortress, none have ever been known to escape. For this is Grimbody Keep, one of England's largest public schools. This is the setting for today's classic story, Tim Brown's School Days.
Grimbody Keep. What happy memories I carry in my heart of that grey, moss-covered, crumbling ruin, the headmaster, Mr. Thatcher. I recall the friends of my youth who stood beside me in times of trouble and never lifted a finger to help. Oh, and I remember Betty, the milkmaid, who was so dear to all of us boys, though only half price to the masters. One of my happiest recollections is of cooking by an open fire till I was quite done on both sides. Oh, golden memories indeed. But let me take you back with me to that moment long ago when I stood, a fresh-faced, apple-cheeked young lad, before the gates of Grimbody Keep for the very first time. I said.
You rang, sir?
I had to. The bell was broken. I am Tim Brown, the new boy.
Well, step inside, young.
He said.
Fellow, I have to keep the door shut on account of the wolves.
Surely there aren't any wolves out on the moors.
Bless ye, no, sir. They're inside. Headmaster keeps them for amusement. He sets them on the matron every now and again for a bit of a laugh.
Oh, I see. Are you one of the masters here?
Bless ye, no, sir.
Well, what is your position?
I'm usually hunched up like this. But first of all, you must go and see Mr. Thatcher, the headmaster. You like him. He's a regular gentleman. Takes castor oil twice a day. Now, come here. This is his study, so in you go and good luck.
Come in, whoever you are. Ha, 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 ha. Ha, 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 ha.
He chortled.
Come in, dear boy.
He said.
Come in, he repeated. Shut the door behind you. We don't want Brutus to escape, now do we?
Is Brutus your dog?
No, he's the Latin master. Well, what a clean-limbed, healthy young lad you are, to be sure. But we'll soon put that right. Now then, what's your name?
Tim Brown, sir.
Brown, eh? Well, I'm sure we'll be chums. You'll live in room 13. It's a single room. But I'm afraid you'll have to share. Still, I'm sure you won't mind. The other 25 don't.
That night, I lay awake, looking through the dormitory window and wishing I was inside. Oh, next morning, it was time for our history lesson with old Mr. Totteridge, who was a little hard of hearing.
Good morning, boys.
Good morning, Mr. Totteridge.
Oh, dear, they can't have arrived yet. Well, never mind. I'll carry on without them. Yes, that's what I'll do. I'll carry on. Yes. I'll carry on without them. Yes.
Please, sir, we're here.
There you are. I was going to carry on without you, you know. But as you're here, I won't bother. Goodbye.
Sir, tell us about William the Conqueror.
Ah, yes. Now, there was a great lady. I knew her. She was a very good. Absolutely marvelous. She was a very, very good friend. A friend of mine. And I was taking her. I well remember. I was taking her to day. I was going to take her to dinner one night. And I'm not boring you, am I?
It was 2 hours later when we filed out of the classroom. It took us that long to get through the bars.
As
we returned to schoolhouse, a freckled-faced young lad took my elbow and ran off with it. I caught up with him and he introduced himself.
Hello, my name's Dobkins Minor. You must be Tim Brown, the new boy. Let's slope off to the tuck shop. I expect Mrs. Greystone will be glad to meet you.
Wizard, come on.
The school tuck shop was a wonderland to my youthful gaze, full of marvelous sweeties who sat around in their underwear. Mrs. Greystone produced two huge cakes, one chocolate and one strawberry. I had a bit of the chocolate, and Dobkins had a bit of the other. Suddenly, the door burst open and a tall, rugged boy with dark, evil hair and a broken voice swaggered in. It was Flashman, the school bully.
Sir, what are we here? What's your name, Pipsqueak?
Tim Brown.
Can you fight Brown?
No, but I can see red.
That's not very funny.
Well, I'm rather nervous.
Look here, Flashman. I'm not going to let you hit Brown before my face.
All right, I'll hit your face first. Come on, Brown.
No, fighting is wicked.
No, it isn't.
It is the way I fight. Take that.
Oh! You bit my nose. That's not fair. Right. Right, you're in for a good hiding. I'll put you in the broom cupboard. They'll never find you there.
Now, come along, boys. I made some tea, so why don't you have a cup and say you're sorry? Believe me, when you tasted it, you will be sorry.
All right, I apologize, Brown.
With that, Flashman spun on his heel, drilling a neat hole in the floor through which he fell. Help! I was moved by his apology, but something he said as he left made me doubt his sincerity.
I'm a liar.
But no sooner had he left than a red-faced, well-built man entered. I knew at once that this was none other than Rudyard Kipling. But I was wrong.
Good heavens, it's Mr. Trimfettle, the games master.
Yes, I say hello, Mrs. G. I say I'm sorry to bother you and all that. But I'm a little short of cash. I wonder, could I touch you for 5 bob? Now, you see, the trouble is, we're playing harrow, or rugby, rugger, or soccer on Saturday. Or it may be cricket. Anyway, point is, we haven't got a team, you see. And I'm in a terrible state, and I just don't know what to do with myself.
Please, sir.
Don't say it.
I can play rugger.
Can you? I say that's first rate. Now, look. Now, look, I suppose we'll need one or two other chaps to make up the team.
Rugger teams don't wear makeup, sir.
No. Well, I know so little about games. I did extra singing when I was at school.
And so we started at once. It was quite a job, as most of the team had never played before. But I hit upon the ruse of putting itching powder in their beds, and they were soon up to scratch. Before the match, Flashman gave the team a pep talk.
All right, you snivelling bunch of lily-livered poltroons. We'll be playing on our own home ground, so that's an advantage to us, especially with regard to the landmines. Now, try to lure them down the pavilion end as much as possible. They can't possibly find their way back through the swamp. Well, when you meet Harrow on the field, we're going to go out there and lick them. I know it's unhygienic, but it's only polite. All right, lads, go out there and give them all you've got. Ah, Headmaster and Mr. Tottery.
Well, Flashman, I must say they look a very fine team. Don't you think so, Mr. Tottery?
What? Yes, a very fine team.
There they go, Corn School. Show them what you're made of. That's not what I meant, Dobkins.
What's happening?
Come on, school.
Come on, school.
Look at Tim Brown. Look at him go.
It's all right. He'll be back in a minute.
Yes, there he is. He's got the ball. He's beaten one man. He's beaten two. My word, he knows how to use that cane.
He's running down the wing.
It's an open goal.
Shoot, man, shoot.
Shoot.
He scored.
Well done. What a goal. Well done. He's scored, Mr. Totteridge. He's scored.
Have you? Hooray. Funny game, Canasta.
What a match it was, with the cheers of the crowd roaring in our ears. Our 11 played like 50. Actually, we were 69. After it was over, we were all assembled in the main hall, and after we had been put together again, the headmaster swept in through the door and, putting aside his broom, stepped onto the platform.
Boys, I'm very proud to be standing here before you. I never thought I'd sober up in time. Today, we won the game by 57 goals to nil. A magnificent effort. Pity the other team didn't turn up, but there it is. Hero of the moment is, of course, our captain, Tim Brown. And now we'll all sing the school song. I see Mr. Totteridge is at the piano, looking immaculate in white tie and tails. Insofar as the piano can look immaculate in white tie and tails. Boys, let us sing.
Angus Prunetune brings to an end another edition of I'm Sorry I Read That Again, which was written this week by Tim Brooke Taylor, John Cleese, Graham Garden, Eric Idle, and Bill Oddie. Those taking part were Tim Brooke Taylor, John Cleese, Graham Garden, David Hatch, Joe Kendall, and Bill Oddie, who also wrote the songs. The music was provided by Dave Lee, with arrangements by Leon Cohen, and the whole show was produced by Humphrey Barclay. No flowers, by request. So that's it until the same time next week, when once again, John Otto Cleese will say in stentorian tones...
In stentorian tones.
Program 12 in Season 2 of this outstanding British sketch comedy series, I-S-I-R-T-A, I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again, Tim Brown's School Days, from May 30th, 1966. And with that, we come to the end of this hour of the program. I'm Jake Longwell. Thank you, as always, for your company. I hope you enjoyed my selections. Do join me again soon for another hour of sounds from the golden age of radio. The Upstate Radio Theater is distributed by Quality Radio Productions.